This is Welcome to Prime Time, a Freddy's Nightmares podcast, and this is part two of Jeff Freilich's interview with us. And it is so good. Jeff is the executive producer, the executive producer of Freddy's Nightmares alongside Bob Shea from New Line. This part of the interview goes deep into the Freddy's Nightmares production experience, and I know you're going to enjoy it. So kick back and listen with me right now.
A good example, because I wrote it and directed it, Missing Persons, which you had a lot of fun making fun of the name, but the missing person, the missing people were going to be the children, because she was going to meet them. And it became Tim Bottoms, who, you know, is missing in his own life, right? In the second half. And by the way, Tim Bottoms' best credits, which you didn't mention, this is not to chastise you, by the way, because I loved that podcast. I absolutely loved it. But I thought it was funny, the ones that you brought up for Tim, I don't know that Tim Bottoms would have. Tim Bottoms was the star of Peter Bogdanovich's The Last Picture Show. And he was also the star of the television of the movie Paper Chase.
Yeah.
Right? Those are two rather, but The Last Picture Show put him on the map. He was nobody at that point. Now, you did mention, oddly enough, Johnny Got His Gun, which was Don Trumbo's movie. That he did just after Picture Show, which is fun. I was there when they were shooting Johnny Got His Gun. That was shot at AFI, at the Greystone Mansion, oddly enough. And it was Trumbo's first shot at really making his own film in many, many, many years. And Chris Trumbo was his first AD during that time. It was before Chris and I started to write together. But now the conundrum was, all right, how do you make 44 episodes out of 22 hours? How do you preserve the same cast? How do you keep the same director at it? But it allows you to kind of cross-board scenes, so that what we found ourselves doing is we'd alternate from show to show depending upon what set we were on. So an actor would have to run, change everything. But in Missing Persons, for example, it was first the babysitter story, which is a girl who was an overeater who was terrified. It was basically an eating disorder fear. And the second one was a guy who was trapped in a life he didn't like. And you saw how, I mean, the plant that I put in the beginning of that was that he's very flirtatious, Tim Bottoms is, to Eva LaRue when he opens the door and sees her. Yeah. Why? Right? Now, it's the old trope of the dad and the babysitter kind of thing, right? But it really was to be paid off in the second half hour, where she becomes kind of the noir mall, right? To his kind of underworld guy, you know, who is trapped in this car accident. And that story was really about your life flashing in front of your face as you die from a car accident. That's what that was. And the first one was all of her fears. But that became a really difficult problem to solve on an ongoing basis. But I had good people around me. And here are the people I had, and it was very, very few. John Betjewel. I brought in, I thought that the show needed, because we were going to be doing a lot of shows, you know, involving female voices, and it was a tough time in television as a woman writer to get a job. But I had met a very, very good writer on The Incredible Hulk named Jill Donner. And so I asked her to come on board. And she brought sensibilities that we never would have had to the show and to characters. Because we would rewrite these things together, a lot of them. Because we hired outside writers to come in and pitch ideas, and they'd write scripts, but they weren't very good, or they weren't good enough, and we were under time pressure, so we did it ourselves, gave them the credit. So every time you see somebody's name on it, odds are 99% of the stuff was not their work. But except Jake Happy, by the way. I don't want to take that credit away from him. Because John Betjewel preserved his work and loved his writing. And that's where I met Jay, by the way. We'd been lifetime friends ever since 1988. But Jay's scripts weren't really touched much because they were really good. And because he had Jonathan working with him, he gave Jay notes, but he didn't rewrite Jay's work. But we rewrote everything. And the third person was this person. This kid at the time, Michael DeLuca.
Never heard of him.
Bob Chase. Bob Chase. Exactly. Bob Shea. And for those people listening to the podcast, we'll find out a lot about who he is right now. But Mike was kind of fresh out of film school at Tisch. he was working, doing odd different things creatively for Bob Shea. Shea took a liking to him. He became kind of his surrogate son. Mike became very close to me because Bob said, look, you just take Mike. Mike is a walking encyclopedia of Nightmare on Elm Street. He'll also know what we're planning to do. So if you come up with an idea that we've either done or are planning to do, he can tell you to go a different direction. He can help preserve the legacy and the franchise. And at the same time, he's a geek for this stuff. And I wasn't. You know, for me, I was more into fantasy. So I had One Step Beyond or Twilight Zone and stuff like that. But I was never really into horror and until this. But I was a good storyteller. So, I mean, I could come up with good ways to kill people, but I didn't sometimes know how to. You know, there are rules as there, you know, there's rules in horror, there's rules in science fiction, there's rules in drama. And if you break those rules, the audience is very savvy and they realize it and they resent it. And so I wanted to be very, I wanted to serve the audience as well as I could. And Mike, I don't know if I should tell you this, but you know, Mike had undergone some jaw surgery and he was very shy. He had a lot of metal in his mouth, which was going to be gone soon enough, but he didn't smile a whole lot and he didn't really like to talk a lot. And he was very shy and he spent a lot of time with me and I quickly learned just what a genius he was. And he would sit in my room while I'd be writing and I'd say, why don't we write this together? You know, I'm not a writer. Yeah, you sure you are. You know, you have great ideas. We'll do this together. So we started to become a kind of team. And we came up with the story for the first episode that we brought in David Ehrman to write. David Ehrman was the brother-in-law of Tim Hunter. The whole thing is circular. This is the most incestuous business of all time. Just ask Jamie Lee Curtis. And so the story, though, was ours, and we had to get permission from Bob, but Bob loved the idea to do the Genesis story because nobody had ever done it before. And Bob actually was entertaining making a feature out of that one day, but we said, no, you won't, and it's better as an hour television show. And the score was Toby Hooper because the man who wrote and directed the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre can't beat him, okay? He is going to come in with exactly the sensibility that you need to do this, all the way down to the extreme close-up of the mouth and the grunting in the background that you heard. That's Toby. And chaining him up and putting him in a glass cage. These are Toby's ideas. And the only problem with Toby Hooper is he didn't know that a day only lasts 24 hours and that a shooting day was supposed to last 12 to 14. And we would work 18, 19, 20 hours. There was one day, in fact, where the entire crew showed up with black armbands on because they'd been working such long hours. And the Teamster captain came over to me and he said, look, we're dying. It's Thursday. He said, we're dying. We're not going to have any weekend. And so I just made a unilateral decision to give them all Friday off and pay them for it. I should come back Monday, 3-day weekend, come back Monday, fresh. It's not going to get any easier, but it's going to be a good show. And Toby will be gone soon, right? So because he was really making life tough. But DeLuca and I and Betchewell really were the ones who kind of guided this show. And the joy of having someone like Gil Adler, who is so tapped into kind of low budget and sometimes horror people, was that he helped channel toward us people like Ken Wiederhorn and Mick Garris and John LaFia, George Kaxander, some really wonderful directors who became friends of mine for years later. Some of them went on to do a series I created right after Freddy's called Dork Justice. They went home and directed some of those too, but they were great. You know, to have Mick Garris come in and do an episode of TV was unusual, but the caveat, the carrot that I gave each of these directors, because it was unheard of in television, was make your own version of it. I'm not going to tell you what to shoot. I'm not going to tell you what you're shooting is wrong. I'm not going to tell you you can't change the script. And I'm going to give you as close to a final cut as you can get it, as long as it's down to time. But come and make your own little movie. You don't have to wait 3 years in development to see it get made. You're going to go and shoot it. and I'll help you cast it, because I had friends who were actors. So we brought in people like Mariska Hargitay, who did Ken Wiederhorn's thing that Alan Katz and Gil Adler yeah. wrote, which was Freddy's Tricks and Treats. Mariska had been, you know, on Falcon Crest. So I called her up and said, would you do me a favor and come and do this? Because her career was just really starting to blossom. Brett Cullen, who I also had on Falcon Crest, who I'd seen on The Thornbirds, who went on to do a zillion different things, including recently Narcos, but he's been doing zillions and stuff. He's a really wonderful actor. Tim Bottoms, you know, who came out of nowhere, came down from Santa Barbara to make this show. Eva LaRue, who was the babysitter, you left out her biggest credit, which I was surprised by because it's such a standard, but she was one of the leads on CSI Miami for all of its years on television.
I did miss that, yeah.
And, I like this. And it's almost like you didn't recognize her.
I like this beating on
Dave. Because she became an adult. It's so funny, but it was like, you know, I had seen CSI Miami and I didn't recognize her on it. Years later, it's like, wow. And I know her manager, and he said, did you see Eva? I got her. See, I said, what? And Eva had like grown up. It's funny because she was a teenager when she worked on Freddy's Nightmares. And then she did an episode of Dark Justice later on too. But that was her first role. She came in and read for Freddy's Nightmares, and I gave her the role in Missing Persons. And she was thrilled, and she was good. And it's hard to believe when you look at that job that she did, that she really had not acted in dramatic television before. Something magic happened on that episode, by the way, that you may or may not have noticed. But knowing you guys, you probably did notice it, but you probably didn't think twice about it. But when Tim Bottoms opens the door and you see Eva, you see snow falling in the background.
I did not.
Snowflakes all over the place. Okay. Now, here's what you got. Look at it again. You'll see it. But here's what happened. I'm inside the house and I'm rehearsing a scene with those two little kids, because when you're working with kids on a movie set, they are on a very limited time schedule. You only get kids for 4 or 6 hours. They have to go to school, as it were. You know. And so what happened was that I'm inside and the AD comes running and says, we have a lot of trouble. It was very, very cold. It was way out in the Steamy Valley, which is maybe 35 miles northwest of the city of Los Angeles, out in the middle of nowhere. But we could find a nice house out there that we could afford to rent as a location. And he said, it's snowing out. It's not going to match anything. And I said, no, are you kidding? That's fantastic. It's a dream. The whole show is a dream. I said, this is like, we couldn't have paid for that. That's amazing. Let's go shoot that right now before it stops. Because nobody had ever seen snow in the valley in Southern California before. This was 1988. This year, where we've had one big storm after another, there's been quite a bit of snow just outside. My daughter lives in Glendale. She sent me a photograph. It looked like she lived in Colorado. I mean, it was very unusual. But back then, it snowed. So it was like, what better for a dream show than snow in Southern California? So that was, it was a combination, I think, of Gil Adler's connections with directors, and Bob Shea, who did some incredible backroom negotiating with people that had worked with him that owed him favors. And I'm talking about, you know, like our production designer, for example, was Mick Strawn. Mick had done Nightmare 3, right? So it's like, well, who are we going to get to be production designer on a show and we're going to pay them 25 cents an hour and give them a bologna sandwich, right? I'll get people to do favors to it. You know, like there was a list of people that came from the Nightmare on Elm Street side, as well as directors who were willing to work for Bob Shea because he could give them a feature. Yeah. In the meantime, Mike DeLuca, who would sit in my office most of the time or come and sit with me on set, became a better and better and better writer, good storyteller, but he also was intent on getting New Line to do more than just Nightmare on Elm Street. I mean, he'd find scripts in the trash where readers would throw them out. and take them to Bob and say, somebody threw this out, but I think we should make this. And Boogie Nights is a good example. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, House Party.
Yeah.
And finally, it was Mike DeLuca, ultimately, who convinced Bob Shea to buy Lord of the Rings and to make all three of them at the same time.
Genius.
But that's a slightly separate story. I'll tell you that one in a minute. But if you're interested.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But that was how we made Freddy's Nightmares. It was a lot of people working at breakneck pace. Necessity being the mother of invention is definitely not only a cliche, but a truth. Because a lot of what you see there, which today we could do in CGI, it would be maybe pricey, maybe not. Almost everything we did was practical visual effects. The dancing food, you guys were right. We shot the pizza in reverse, right?
Yeah.
You know, all of those, the hot dogs and stuff like that, they were split in half so they could, you know, talk. But they were all on little wires. This was mixed drawn and other people involved in visual effects from New Line. It was like borrowing, it was like making an indie film in the era of Roger Corman and borrowing people from their very well, you know, traveled sets. People with a lot of experience at inventive ways of doing things for no money, and took great pleasure in doing that. You don't see that today. You don't see people on a set, and I've made shows for a lot of money, and I've made shows for less money in the last 40 years, but very rarely do you say to somebody in the prop department or in the art department, this is what I want, it's incredibly ambitious, but we only have a dollar to make it, and have them go, fabulous. Right? Most of them go, shit, what do you expect? It's not, we're never going to do it. You know, the people on this show never said that. The people on this show would get a big grin on if it was a challenge. I'll bet you can't do this. Oh, yeah? Watch. And they'd run off and they'd come back and they'd present it to you with glee. And it would be, that's fantastic. You know, and thank you. You bailed us out. I don't know how you did it, kind of thing. Another little anecdote, by the way, from Missing Persons, and I'll go back to the very first episode in a second, but you commented on the babysitter comes in and she finds two kids chained to the wall, right? One of them is my son, Nick, with all the scars on his face. That was 1988. He was born in 1982. He was probably 6.5 years old. I thought I'd put him in the show. It was for an afternoon. I really wanted him to learn the making of horror so that he wasn't terrified by it, but more entertained by it, right? So I brought him to work and walked with him because he had to be made up. That was a lot of work, to the makeup trailer. And as I walked in, I said, hi to everybody. And turning around, because I could see it coming, I saw the hat was Bob, Robert Englund. Turns around, made up now. And I felt my son kind of try to find a way to dig himself a hole in the floor and was trembling. And Robert reached out and he said, Nick. He said, Nick, my name is Robert. He said, look at this. And he started to pinch his skin. He said, come over here. And I led Nick over to Robert, and he put him on his leg, and Nick is terrified. And he says to Nick, do you get dressed up for Halloween? And he says, yeah. He said, that's what I do. It only takes 5 hours. Kevin Yeager to put all this stuff on me. 5 hours. But that's, he said, look, take this piece of my arm and rip it off and see what happens. And Nick pulled a piece of the prosthetic rubber off and he started to laugh because now he controlled it, right? Now it wasn't afraid, you know, he wasn't afraid anymore. He was kind of part of the game. And so Robert said, well, I'm going to have them put this back on. I'm going to go down to the set. Now it's your turn to get all scary looking. And so they worked on it. So I took Nick onto the stage, and there's Robert and people standing around. And I'm directing this episode, right? And Nick was onto the stage. Robert turns, sees him, screams, and runs and hides. And Nick cracks up. Nick is walking out there going, Robert, it's me. It's Nick. It's okay. It was priceless.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, and to this day, it's funny. My son never became a horror fan. My daughter did. She was my assistant on Wrong Turn 2 when she was in college. She was going to NYU, and she came to Vancouver with me on that. And she loves the intricacies of it. But remember, that was made years later with a lot more money. Yeah. And between Bill Tarazakis' incredible prosthetics and a lot of CGI and Joe Lynch's boundless imagination, it was much bigger than life. Joe himself is bigger than life. So the movie itself was. And Henry Rollins, who became friends with Molly for years and would invite her to come and see him do his spoken word tour and stuff like that when he was in New York. It's a very small community. And we had Fangoria people there all the time. It was kind of fun. But Freddy's was this little shack in the middle of the valley next to a bar. It was a rundown warehouse that was really never used for movie making. It may have been used for porn for all I know, but I don't know that for sure. Yeah. It's the only thing I could think of at the time. And DeLuca and I would go next door and have a drink and play pool and come up with ideas. And then go back on set and see how it was going. I always felt, and Mike DeLuca was kind of a representative of one of the studios in Lilla, I always felt that directors and actors work better without their parents' supervision, you know, and like I did my homework better when my mother wasn't sitting in the room waiting for it to be handed to her. So in this case, I thought, let's let them, in the spirit of go make your own movie, leave them as alone as possible and let us generate new ideas. And that's basically what we did. And I got a very good working relationship with DeLuca going. And let me just for a second finish what I know of Mike DeLuca's unbelievable and successful and celebrated career at this point. I left Freddy's after the first season to become a consultant on the show. We did 44 half-hour stories. I was getting to the point where my mind was in such a dark place because every day I would wake up and think of more and more grotesque things to do to people. Yeah. That's what I was totally preoccupied with all the time. And I, on one hand, I wanted to move on to something new and different and fresh. And on the other, it was a really difficult job. It was a lot of hours. I never really got to see my family at all. It was far, far away from where I lived. So the commute was 2 hours round trip. God,
brutal.
And then we'd go work for 14, 15, 16 hours. So talk about not having a life. So I was off developing a new show for Jeff Sagansky, who just had taken over CBS, the president of CBS. And he wanted to fill the 11 o'clock slot or the 11:30 slot with, instead of a talk show, an hour of what he called crime time.
Oh, yes.
He wanted
yes.
an hour, right? Crime time after prime time is what it was called. And he reached out to the two people who, when he was at NBC, were not only loyal to him, but he liked our work. It was me and Stephen J. Cannell. Steve Cannell, who is a legendary writer-producer in television, who passed away several years ago, but Steve Cannell created a ton of well-known television shows. He had me come in. I went in with, of all people, Les Moonves, who's now famous for all kinds of reasons that you wish he were famous for. But Les was the executive vice president of Lorimar at the time. And I pitched Jeff Sagansky an idea for a show, which he had a couple of ideas for also, and gave me an order for 22 episodes in the room without ever reading a pilot, without second-guessing my casting or anything else, to just go make a great show. What the catch was that it was at a reduced license fee, and he thought that would scare me. As it turns out, having just come off of Freddy's, nothing is cheaper than Freddy. If I could produce a show for that amount of money on Freddy's, this was a little more, I could do this. But I knew, based on my experience on Freddy's, what the limitations of writing would be. And I also realized that I needed to put together a writing staff that had a very few people, because I couldn't afford a lot of writers. And we would do the same thing we did on Freddy's, bring in people, rewrite them, you know, and write a lot of them ourselves in-house, do it with the minimal number of notes from the outside, which meant we didn't have to do multiple drafts of anything. And I reached out to the people that I had the most respect and admiration, creative admiration for. And number one on the list is Mike DeLuca, who's working at New Line. And I called him and I said, look, you know, I got this new show. Would you come on as an executive story consultant? He said, I can't leave Bob. I said, well, you know what? I'm not asking you to leave Bob. Are you there all the time at New Line? He said, no. And I said, would you be available to do some consulting work when we had story meetings? He said, sure. I said, would you be available to write a couple or a few scripts or rewrite somebody else's work? He said, sure. I said, because your sensibility, your storytelling would be invaluable to the show. And I told him what the show was and he loved it. Second person, Jay Cappy, who I met on Freddy's through Jonathan Betchel, who reached out to Fred Decker, who brought James Cappy in, and then Fred dropped out as the director. Jonathan took over instead. And Jay wrote two wonderful scripts and became a friend of mine. And it's like, I'd love to spend a year in a room with Jay Cappy and make this show. And then the third person at the time was a guy named Duke Stondifer, who I'd known and worked with in the past. And ultimately, I brought Chris Trumbull on board. And it was a very small group. But here's the funny part about DeLuca, because it's not Dark Justice I want to talk about. It's DeLuca. When the show went on the air, not only was Mike DeLuca's name on the credits as executive story consultant, but I named the artist for the artwork that was used. I know if you remember in the Iger sanction, he was an assassin who was paid in artwork. So in the pilot of Dark Justice, Shane Black plays the villain, who's called the Yuppie Hitman. I wrote the pilot and directed it. And he's called Caldecott Rush, which I thought was a yuppie enough name. And I think DeLuca had a finger in that name as well, by the way. And the painting that he's paid with is a DeLuca, because I thought it would be a good name for an artist. So I get this call. All right, the show's on at 11 o'clock Friday night. 12:15, I get a phone call from Bob Shea on a Friday night. So you pay homage to your big fan, your friend DeLuca, and you hire him, and you don't mention me at all.
That's so funny.
So I made a VHS box that said Bob Shea presents Dark Justice, written, directed, and produced by Bob Shea. I put a VHS in it and I sent it over to New Line. But the thing that hadn't been discussed yet is, what is Mike DeLuca doing with a credit on your show?
Yeah.
And I said, look, this is what I'm paying him, which was a lot more than he was paying him. Mike managed to buy his house with the first year's Dark Justice money. Wow. And I said, and he's brilliant. And I said, are you missing him? Is he not doing his job? No, he's great. He's amazing. I said, so what's the, So the next thing I know, I'm shortcutting all of this, but DeLuca is saying, what did you say to Shay? I said, what are you talking about? He just made me vice president of New Line. So what happened, it's a great story, because what happened over 3 years of Dark Justice, the first year he was a lot more a part of the show. I was in Barcelona making that show. The first year we had to go to Spain to make the show because it was on such a low budget that I had to go around the world and find money. And Barcelona was willing to, TV Catalunya was willing to put up half the budget in exchange for my getting CBS to agree to allow them to air it the same week it aired in the United States, which is unheard of for an American television show. They wanted the prestige of airing an American show at the same time, and the Olympics were coming to Barcelona the next year, and this was a way to draw attention and prestige to the city. And I got CBS to say, sure, I don't care. And that's where I was. And I needed DeLuca on the other end of a phone or Jay on the other end of a phone every once in a while to give notes on scripts that were faxed to me. Remember, this is pre-email. So I'd wake up in the morning with a stack of faxes. And in Spain, they don't have any 8x10 paper. It's all legal size. So I'd be reading these scripts on these legal stories, like reading the original On the Road on a roll of toilet paper that Jack Kerouac wrote on. It just went on forever. And then I talked to DeLuca on the phone. So each year he did a little less physical participation and a little bit more distant communication. And by the time Dark Justice was done, after three seasons and 66 episodes, Mike DeLuca was president of New Line. because it was like a tug of war between me and Bob. And Bob finally was, you know, not only did he always recognized Mike's talent, but he realized that somebody else saw how talented he was. We all did.
Yeah.
And so Mike, in this kind of tug of war, maybe got promoted more quickly than he might have otherwise. but then, as you know, he went on to be president of DreamWorks and president of Sony and president of MGM. And now he's either president or chairman of Warner Brothers. And in the meantime, he also managed to produce almost all of David Fincher's movies, as well as convince Bob Shea to buy the rights to and make at the same time all three Lord of the Rings. His name used to be on that movie. I don't know what happened to it. But when I saw the original trailer, it was there as an exec producer. But he's a phenomenal guy. He was always nice. And that was that's his genesis. So a lot of people actually grew up on Freddy's. And a lot of people kind of got their starts there. Tom DeSimone is somebody I didn't mention.
Yeah.
Tom DeSimone, who directed a lot of Freddy's, was basically a porn director. And largely gay porn, and came to me, and I sat and I talked to him, you know, just to interview him, because, you know, it was very difficult in those days to get a cassette of somebody's work.
Yeah.
You know, VHS cassettes were just, not everybody had them. You certainly didn't have them for your work unless the studio planned to put them out. The machines themselves didn't really come out until the very early 80s, and I remember buying my first RCA for $1,000 for a VHS machine that had a remote control on a wire. You had to sit on the other end of the room. You could never put it far enough, you know, away. It was always, I think our VHS machine was in the middle of the room because the remote could only stretch to the couch a certain distance, right? You know, so you had to walk over the extension cord to get to the kitchen. But I think that you know, the combination of these kind of new, very talented people in an atmosphere that had very few restrictions and rules also made us less picky sometimes about who we hired. And very often I would hire directors based on a personality test. And I'd sit and we'd talk. And if I liked somebody, great. You know, do a great job. I would hear something about somebody would say, oh, I saw his movie. Some of his movies were very difficult to find. You know, horror films don't run very long in the theaters, and we didn't have streams or any other outlet for them, and they didn't run on TV very often. And most of the time when they did make it to TV, they were so severely edited that they lost a lot of what made them so delicious or scary, right? And so that's how we met so many people. But DeSimone was terrific, and I realized, what's the difference between my working for Roger Corman and his making gay porn?
Yeah, I mean,
it's the same stuff, basically. He was a film lover. All he ever wanted to do was make movies. So he went in the direction that he could. It was the only thing that he was allowed to make at the time. And nobody else wanted to hire him for anything else until we brought him onto Freddy's, which really was the beginning. And he did a whole bunch of Dark Justices. He did Freddy's both in the first season and in the second season when I had already left and was just consulting on the show, because his episodes were so good. And because of the background that he came in, there was no black armband on the crew. Mm-hmm. Tom DeSimone could shoot a 12-hour day and make it a really good show. He knew exactly what shots he needed. He knew how to take one shot and make it into five shots, so he wouldn't have to keep moving the camera around. And he was pleasant to everybody and complimentary to everybody, and he gave actors really cogent, thoughtful notes, character-based, goal-motivated notes, which is an art form in itself. It's very tough, especially in television, because you don't have the number of takes and the time, you don't have the rehearsals, you don't have any of the time you have in features to craft a performance. You're really doing it on the fly, so you have to be very careful about the words that you use. Obviously, as much as I talk, I wasn't great at containing the number of words that I would use for actors, but I tried. But the point is that Tom DeSimone is really, really, really good at that. So, you know, that was, for me, that was Freddy's. The bad news for us, although it turned into good news because it gave birth to people like you guys and Joe Lynch, was that I found out it was airing on a Sunday night at 6 o'clock in Philadelphia.
Jeez.
It's like, I told you guys, of all cities, right, where there's still blue laws, right? I told you guys at Warner Brothers that this is an adult show that needed to be aired late at night. What are you thinking? And instead, they went ahead and aired it all over the country at different times. So when I met Joe, when I first was contacted by you or even listening to your podcast, where I've met other people who remember studies, where I ran into a director that we had, a Belgian woman who wrote for Fangoria. It was a horror. She's a huge horror fan. Axel Carolyn, who did a couple of episodes of Anne Rice's Mayfair Witches, which is the newest show that I was exec producer on last year. She came up to me, knew that I had done Freddy's because she had watched them all on Tubi, and told me that it was on Tubi because I had no idea it was on Tubi. And she's probably early 30s, mid-30s. I have no idea how old she is. I didn't ask her, but how did you even know about Freddy's Nightmares? Well, she explained to me that if you really are into horror, there's not much you don't know about. And I kind of found that out from some horror fans after long term. But you go hunting for that. And so, you know, I at least now, having rewatched the first season, which I really wanted to do after 30 some odd years, I wanted to see, because sometimes you lose sight of what you made, and sometimes your perception of things that you worked on in your life is completely different than the second time that you see it. I have dug scripts out of file cabinets that I have that I wrote 40 years ago that I'm afraid to look at because I'm afraid that they're just so bad that, you know, and I read them and sometimes you forget you wrote them, and sometimes they're a lot better than you thought. Sometimes the things that you thought that were great really suck. And so your perception changes, not only with, you know, the temperature outside, but, you know, your own development. And so when I watched Freddy's Nightmares, I thought, you know, we hit a lot of high notes. There was a lot of ground broken that was, you know, repeated later. I think Tales from the Crypt did a lot of borrowing from our concept. But we allowed them to exist, and they were on pay television. So they could go beyond where we went, and they had a lot more money to make the shows with, and they had, you know, more expensive pedigree producers and a lot more time to shoot their shows on. But we opened the door for that on television. We had an interesting situation where in the middle of making the show, I was invited to be on a talk show in San Francisco, a television talk show, where I was going to debate a couple of, you know, television psychiatrists on the evils of horror and the effect that they have on children. Now, having gone to USC Medical School, my closest friend at USC Medical School was then a doctor by the time 1989 came around, named Lisa Jay. And Lee was either the head of psychiatry or one of the heads of psychiatry at UCLA Medical Center here in Los Angeles. But his specialty was disturbed teenagers, cult attracted teenagers, serial killing teenagers, all of these things. So I called Lee and I said, look, I got to go to San Francisco and I need backup. And I knew what his feeling was about all of this, because we already had the debate about, should we let our sons have toy guns? Should we let them play violent video games? And we both agreed that there was nothing wrong with doing that, as long as it was done in the right kind of environment, in the right spirit. And so we went up to San Francisco, and there is this, you know, this woman who was ready for a big fight and claimed to have all of these facts. They are what we now have learned during the Trump era to call fake facts. But horror causes irreparable injury to the psyches of young people. And I was already, and Rachel Talley came cool. with us also, because she was going to go off and do and direct, and she was the representative of New Line. So from the feature side of Nightmare on Elm Street, there was Rachel, there was me from television, and there was Lisa Jay, who I brought that they were totally unprepared for. And I sat there and said to her that research has shown that children need this kind of release sometimes, that sometimes, as do adults. But I said that when I was writing, producing The Incredible Hulk, there were parents who would call up and complain to CVS that we were showing their children violence, but there were way more parents who would call and tell me personally about their kids who used to be so introverted that they would contain all of their anger and bang their head against the wall. And they would see The Incredible Hulk and start to present the anger that they had, and made them much better behaved, much more relaxed, much more grounded children, because they saw that it was okay to let that out. And I said that when it came to horror, I said, it's since time, since the first play that was ever written, since the Greek tragedy, since you know, we all grew up on horror stories, the Brothers Grimm. I said, you know what, though? There's a story that I wouldn't have put on Freddy's Nightmare. She said, what is that? I said, abusive parents who abandon their children in the woods, they find their way to this house. A kindly woman feeds them with the intent to cook them and eat them, and these two kids turn into serial killers and push her into an oven and kill her. You said, well, I wouldn't tell that story either. I said, that's Hansel and Gretel. I said, we were all raised on that story, okay? All children are raised on Little Red Riding Hood, your grandma's eaten by the wolf. You know, these are things that are necessary for kids, because just like psychotherapy teaches us, when you're in group therapy or even in single therapy, most of our fears are that what's going on with us is unique to us and there's something wrong with us. But when you articulate problems that you have, fears that you have, pain that you have, and find out that you're not alone, it's therapeutic. You know, and that's what horror is about. If you're watching horror or reading horror, you can somehow communicate with the feelings that the protagonists are having, and exercise your own demons that way. And that's what the vast majority of the people that I now have come to know in, you know, as horror fans and horror writers and critics will talk about. It's like, I felt just like that. I walked out feeling so much better. It's not so much a question of I was scared to death and I don't know what to do and now I'm going to have nightmares the rest of my life. It was more like an exorcism. It was more like there are things that have been building up in me and I got it out of me. You know, you could come in just having a bad day at the office, watch a horror movie, and walk away and forget all about it.
I think Dave does that a lot, you know, actually.
So that's what we were doing with Freddy's. And then, of course, you know, Rachel made similar comments to mine. And she was still trying to debate it, talking about clinical this and test that. And Lee just blurted out, because Lee's a very quiet guy. He was a Freudian psychotherapist, so they don't talk at all, right? They just listen to you. But he stopped her cold. He said, that's not true. He said, I've done tons of research. I have read volumes about this. It's therapeutic. He said, if taken in the right context, he said, anything can be injurious to anybody if taken the wrong way. And he said, and of course you don't let your five-year-old sit down in front of a TV and walk away and let them watch Freddy's. If you're going to let a child watch the show, be with them. It took me back to the story with Nick. It's like the minute my son realized that Robert Englund was in makeup, the fear went away. The entertainment did not go away. The fear when he watched the show didn't go away, but then he rationalized it by going, oh, no, that's all make-believe. But it was a great ride. It's the same as getting on a roller coaster. You're not going to die, but you think you are. And that's what makes it exciting. And that's why we went out of our way when my kids were young to go on roller coasters where the bolts were loose on the side, because maybe you could really die, right? You go on at Coney Island, I swear to God, and you were the only ones, my son and I, when they went on on the roller coaster in Coney Island back in the late 80s, and nobody else was going on it. And the guy who was selling tickets was behind a cage because people were robbing him. You know? So nobody else was on it. Nobody else was on it. And we get on the thing. And as we're going up the first long incline, Nick pointed out that not only were all the bolts rusty, but they were all loose also, right? He could see. It's a wooden roller coaster. It's shaking, right? So, but that's the equivalent of horror.
Yeah.
Right? The potential that something horrible could happen. And the more you invest yourself in the fantasy as a fan or a viewer, the more you get out of it, obviously, because you let yourself go on that ride. And it's those people who say, I can't look, that miss 100%. Out, you know? You want to. That's why actually horror is even better to go to see in a theater with a lot of other people who are yelling, don't go down that hall. Yep. You know, that's what you want. It becomes again, it goes back to the team sport thing. Comedy and horror are always better in a large group because you hear laughter, you hear screams. You know, the other quiet moments, the depressing movies, you can sit in your room by yourself and stream those if you want to. You don't need to sit in a room with 1,000 people and cry.
I like that, but that's just me.
Scream, yes. You want to hear other people scream? You know, you want to play the game where you scream before they do, you know, just to get them nervous before it happens. You want to grip the person's knee next to you before something horrible happens. It's all fun. It's all part of the same thing. And so when we left that show, which kind of for me was the going full circle with that show, Freddy's Nightmares, when we left that talk show, you know, I left knowing a lot more about what we were making than I did walking in, having a greater appreciation for the value. And now looking at it 40 years, 35 years later, realizing that some of what we did was incredibly outlandish. I mean, I don't know, you know, Brad Pitt walking out of a phone booth getting run over. You know, it was, and by the way, you realize the 1989 when we cast Brad Pitt for Black Tickets, and that was George Kaxander, I think, directing it, and Howard Lakin, who had worked with me on Falcon Crest, wrote that episode. His mom was my boss on Flamingo Road, Rita Lakin. She was a wonderful writer. And I knew Howard because Howard also went to Antioch. Yeah. Not when I was there, but his mother, Rita, said, my son went to the same college you did. I said, really? You know, she introduced me. He was 15 years younger. And so I gave him a job on Falcon Crest out of loyalty to the college, but he was a really good writer. He's a really, really good writer. But Brad Pitt wasn't Brad Pitt at that point. You know, Brad Pitt had a mullet and he wasn't really being given juicy roles at all. I think he had done maybe a little bit of, done a couple of daytime soap operas but not as a regular. And I think he did an episode of Dallas. And the reason he got to us was because he was in the Lorimar Warner Brothers casting pipeline and nobody was hiring him yet. By the way, George Clooney went down the same road with Lorimar. It's like people weren't hiring him until he got that one role that made everybody go, where have I been? And then I missed this guy. He's so talented. Well, you know, Brad Pitt can do everything with just a smile. You look at his facial expressions and he sells whatever it was. So Black Tickets, which was a very small show in a lot of ways, physically very small show about, a doomed marriage. He carried that ball so well in it. You really cared about what happened to him. But he also found the humor in the show, which not every actor found. He did the whole thing with a tongue-in-cheek because it was like, you can't be serious. And then, no, we're not really serious, but you got to sell it. So he would. And he was really good at it. But each of the actors that we were lucky enough to attract to the show found what we were trying to do with the show, which is to make something that was entertaining that we realized once they sold the time slots couldn't just be for only adults, that we knew kids were going to watch it too. So that's where the SAT story would come from, or, you know, the sorority story, or even the babysitting story. It was like, okay, fine. If we're going to be showing it to a world of younger people, then let's involve younger people in the storytelling as well and not just make it adults. And then more important than anything else, and this is something you know at least as well as I, is that the very principle of Nightmare on Elm Street is that it's Springwood is a city, is a town where the teenagers have been completely abandoned written off by the adults. And it is the nightmares of teenagers, not the nightmares of adults. So if you're telling the stories about teenage fears, then you can't restrict the audience to only people over the age of 18 or only adults who watch TV at 11 o'clock at night, you know, where kids are already either asleep or watching something else or not watching at all. So we had to kind of be true to the original premise of Nightmare on Elm Street, because it's the reason for these, and this is my own theory, but I thought that the reason why the kids in this town were having nightmares is because they were basically abandoned and abused, not physically, but mentally abused by their parents. And so, I don't know if you ever saw the movie Over the Edge.
I actually just discovered that.
Over the Edge was John. Okay, so I'll tell you, since our friend Jonathan Kaplan directed it and Tim Hunter wrote it. Tim Hunter wrote it with Johnny with Charlie Haas, who is a magazine and novelist, magazine writer and novelist. But Tim Hunter, and as I mentioned before, Tim and Jonathan and I grew up together, and we played poker in the same high school poker, you know, game in Tim's house. But and Jonathan. Roger Corman came to Tim Hunter one day and said, I need a director. A director fell out. We're making a movie called Night Call Nurses. We need a director right away. And Tim said, we have a friend who just got out of NYU named Jonathan Kaplan. I'll bet he'd get on a plane tomorrow and come out and do it. He said, get him on the phone. He said, so he gives the number to Corman. Corman calls and says, Jonathan, this is Roger Corman. And Kaplan said, Hunter, is that you? Fuck you. Hangs up the phone. Didn't believe that it was Roger Corman, right? So Tim had to call back and say, it really is Roger Corman. Got Jonathan on the phone, brought him out. He did Night Call Nurses, which I think was his first picture. And then he did Heart Like a Wheel and Truck Turner. But when he finally started to make legitimate films, that is films that were not for Corman on a budget and exploitation type films, he made Over the Edge, which was based on a magazine article called Mouse Packs. And it was written by Tim and Charlie. But it was about a real town between Boulder and Denver that was built as a kind of upper middle class, all white, escaped from the city and minority people, intentional community for adults. But it wasn't, adults, they didn't say for adults, but that's all they built was for adults. There was no place for kids to play. There was no mall to hang out at. There was no athletic field. There was a school. There was home. That was it. And what a great place for kids to get into trouble, because there's nothing to do. So it grew resentment among the teenagers, very much like Springwood, where the adults were there and they were having their backyard, you know, wine tasting, you know, barbecues. And the kids are, where's your kid? I don't know. He's hanging out watching TV. Or they're hanging out, you know, downtown, sitting on a street corner somewhere. And ultimately, the movie was a true story, but at the end the kids locked up and basically burned down the school, and they carted all the teenagers out of town on a bus. And I think Johnny put Blue Child
as the
music at the end of the movie. The other minor anecdote there is that Jonathan was casting that by going to high schools in New York. He was going around and they were doing auditions in auditoriums. And Jonathan couldn't find the auditorium at one school. And there's this kid sitting in the hallway smoking a cigarette, wearing jeans, which you weren't supposed to wear, in a New York high school. And he said, where's the auditorium? To the kid, and the kid points down the hall. And Jonathan stopped and said, are you an actor? And he said, no, but my brother is. He says, well, why are you coming too? It was Matt Dillon. Yeah. Kevin Dillon was going to read, and Matt Dillon was there also. That's my part of that story. I mean, I know that I've heard that from Jonathan. It was years and years ago. If Jonathan hears this and says it's all wrong, he can correct it. But that's how Matt and you know, Jonathan was very perceptive, because that's what you do. I found Carrie Ann Moss in Spain for Dark Justice. I would walk around when I went to Barcelona for Dark Justice. I had a fit trying to find actors for the show. I could bring over one or two people. I could afford to bring over a couple of American actors to play guest roles, maybe the main villain, maybe the sidekick, whatever it is. I had my four or five leading actors living in Barcelona there. I flew them all over. But I needed to find people who spoke English without an accent. And you had some British actors. You had some American actors. There were very, very few, and none of them were particularly good. And the longer you stay in a country where people speak your language with an accent, the more you think that's the way it's supposed to sound. So I would hear people speak with a Catalan accent and think there's nothing wrong. You know, I had, for example, an actor in the very last episode who was talking about the villain, and she's from Valencia. And she said, he's worse than an animal. That was the line. He's worse than an animal. Well, my assistant, I'm cutting this back in Los Angeles. And my assistant walks by the editing room and he says, Rob Gomes is his name. He's now a producer also. Rob stopped by and said, worse than an enema? I said, no. He said, that's what she's saying. He said, that's what she's saying. Play it back again. So there it is. Now I hear the accent. He's worse than an animal. I went, oh my God. You know, so what I would do is I would walk around in Barcelona on the streets or at the beach or wherever it may be and listen for people who spoke English, and went up to quite a few people saying, have you ever acted?
Wow.
And most of the time they would say no. A couple of times they said no, but I'd love to. In her case, she was with two other women, and I said, you're never going to believe this, but blah, 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 blah. And the other two basically told me to go to hell. And she said, is there like a real phone number that I can call? You know, and so I gave her the phone number of the studio. She called. She came in 3 hours late for her reading, disheveled, filthy. She tells me that she lives 3 hours away. The bus broke down. She had to walk several kilometers. She had to then take a train. She had to walk from the train station. Oh, please don't give the role away. She sat down. She read. Because she was a model for Sears catalog in Spain. She was never an actor. I said, you got the role. I got up. I walked away. I heard footsteps. She came running and jumped on my back and said, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And she did the whole first season and a half of Dark Justice as the assistant to the judge. Got her a green card to come to the United States. She was originally from Vancouver, which is something she never bothered to tell me, but that was okay. When we moved to LA the second season, she came to Los Angeles, introduced her to an agent, and her career started. And, you know, looking back on all of those, the same thing with Mariska and so many other people. And Brad Pitt certainly didn't get his start on Freddy's, but it was one of his first couple of things. And it kind of was his introduction to an unusual kind of character, because he always played such flat, you know, cute guy kind of things. That wasn't what he was doing there. But looking back on it, and people ask me what's the favorite thing I've done or what part of my career was, there's nothing more fun than sitting back. And I've told people this. It's like, one day I want to be sitting in a rocking chair at the motion picture home on the porch drinking a gin and tonic and saying, I remember that guy. I gave that guy or that person their start. You know, I look at what that person did. You know, I do that with DeLuca. It's not like I made his career, but I got to tell you, I was fortunate enough to have him work with me, and for him to turn into who he was something that didn't surprise me at all, nor did so many of these actors that I've worked with or directors. I don't know if you know who Reed Morano is. Reed directed the pilot and was executive producer of The Handmaid's Tale. Reed had been a cinematographer. She had hardly directed anything. She did an indie film with her husband who wrote it, and her son, about the kidnapped child, and her son played the kid, made it for no money. My producing partner on Halt and Catch Fire, which is a series I did for AMC for 4 years about the computer business in the 80s, Melissa Bernstein, who had also been exec producer of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, she had a conduit to women in film. And we thought it was really important to try to hire as many women directors as possible. We had the opportunity to give people jobs, so we chose to be as diverse in our choices about everything as we could. She mentions this person. And it was like, whoa, she's really never done. It's not an easy show to direct. Well, it's tight on time. It's tight on budget. But what else is new? But she was a DP. So she knows it goes on a step, right? So let's see what happens. So Reed came. And I said one afternoon, you want to go to the movie tonight? We've done enough prepping. Shane Black's film, yeah. The Good Guys, that just got out. I said, it's playing by the hotel we were both staying in. I said, why don't we just meet there and go see this movie? He's a friend of mine, you know, and I'm a fan of his work. And she said, I can't. I've got this interview tomorrow. They're talking to me about doing Handmaid's Tale. I said, well, what are you going to do between now and then? She said, I'm going to read the book again. I said, have you read it before? She said, yeah, twice. I said, why do you need to? You think there's going to be a test? Like on page 127, what does she say? You know, I said, none of that's going to happen. Do you have a passion? Do you have a vision? Yes. That's all you're going to need. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll wait outside at 8 o'clock. It starts at 8. I'll buy reserved seats. If you show up, you show up. If you don't show up, you don't show up. At 2 minutes to 8, I hear running footsteps. And the next day she calls me. She was on the phone with them for 3 hours. And she got the job, and she got not only the first episode, but she got all of them. So somebody else is willing to take a chance on her. The reason I brought her up is that she was one of many examples. She went on to direct, in my opinion, the best episode of that series that we ever had. She was a true storyteller. And because she was a cinematographer, she knew how to get the Griffin Electric Department and camera department in sync and to shoot complicated stuff in a simple way, which sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, but there is a way to do it if you know what you're doing to get those complicated shots. I remember her talking about a very complicated dolly with a particular camera pan, and the operator did it because he was fighting her, and he did it, and he said, that's going to look really good. And she said, pretty gangster. Huh? And that endeared her to the entire crew. And she went off and made that great episode and then took off and won the Emmy. And I texted her when she walked off the stage at the Emmy saying, now are you happy that you went to go see The Good Guy? But the point is that there is a joy to honing these things down that I now, after all these years in this business, realize was the joy for Roger Corman. And I can't compare myself to Corman in terms of volume, because look at him. Coppola and Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper and Martin Scorsese and Amy Heckerling and Ron Howard and Peter Bogdanovich. I mean, the list is endless. Jonathan Kaplan, the list, Paul Bartel, who was in Hollywood Boulevard, by the way. Jonathan Kaplan was in Hollywood Boulevard as a PA, spraying women's t-shirts, basically, was his job, right? Jonathan Demme was in Hollywood Boulevard in a Godzilla outfit. Jonathan and I talked about it. We made a pilot together several years ago, and we talked about Corman a lot. We had a fight on the set, Jonathan and I. And that night he knocked on my door at the hotel, very upset that we got into a fight, and brought a joint with him and sat down, and we started to talk. And he said, you and I, we've been around forever. We worked with Corman. We shouldn't be fighting on the set. We should be showing these kids what a fun time all of this is. He said, everything we did today was exactly the opposite. So we came up with a plan where we'd start the next day with a fight and then break out in laughter.
So good.
Right? And it worked. Because the whole crew went, wait a second. Were they fucking with us yesterday too? And it all made it made everything so much better.
Better filmmaking as a result through of gaslighting. It all.
Well, you know, sometimes sometimes you have to do that. So I don't know, you know, I don't know if I've covered enough basis for you. I know that I talked for over 2 hours, and I'm sure that wasn't
we were hoping to just let this go harder. Yeah. No, we were like this. We were already ready. We were like, we know he's got a lot of good stuff.
I apologize to my friends on an ongoing basis because I love telling stories, and I've been fortunate enough to work with directors and filmmakers of different kinds, both writers and actors. But the directors that I worked with, aside from Bogdanovich on 5 or 6 films together, Bob Rafelson and Norman Jewison and John Borman and Lynn Littman and you know, in television, so many really incredible directors. The things that you were calling episodes of TV, yeah. Naked City, for example. Remember you mentioned in something. Naked City, which is on my credits, is something that I left television shortly after Dark Justice. I made one other show talking about long careers. We cast Ben Affleck as a high school football player in a show called Against the Grain. It was his first real role after Mallrats, I think. And he was like 19 or 20. And we were trying to buy the rights to Friday Night Lights, the book at the time. It was 1993. We couldn't get those rights. So the writers came up with something called Against the Grain, which is basically the same story, a small Texas town where football is the life that everybody lives on Friday night. And Ben was the lead. And right after that, my company, arm's length from Warner Brothers, me in partnership with another feature producer named Arnold Copelson, who had just produced The Fugitive with Harrison Ford, but also won an Oscar for Platoon, Arnold did. We had a property called Frogmen. Frogmen was a two-hour pilot for NBC, for Don Ohlmeyer, the president of NBC, who used to be the head of sports there. And it was about an old retired Navy SEAL who puts together a group of young Navy SEALs, and they go to Colombia and they rescue a kidnapped person. And who does NBC want to star in it? O.J. Simpson. Okay. So now I'm executive producer of the movie with O.J. Simpson in 1994, in the spring of 1994. And we shoot for a few days in Long Beach. And we go down to Puerto Rico, but OJ hasn't signed his deal. And the reason why is he wants two tickets to Puerto Rico. And I got a hold of his agent. I said, I'm not letting OJ leave Puerto Rico. Once we go to Puerto Rico, we're going to stay in Puerto Rico. We want to shoot the film. He doesn't need two tickets. And he said, no, it's for his wife. I said, wait a second. His wife? She's why he's not married anymore. What are you talking about? So I call OJ and I said, what is this ticket for? He said, it's for Nicole. He said, we're reconciling. We're making up. I want another ticket. I'm not going to argue over a $1,000 airline ticket, but it seemed really bizarre. One of the things we trained OJ to do is to be a stealth Navy SEAL, because we had a stealth Navy SEAL expert come and train him. And there's a scene in which he sees movement in his beach shack, which is where he lives, and sneaks up on somebody from the back with a knife to her throat, turns her around, and it's his daughter. But that photograph, that still found its way onto the cover of the National Enquirer, trained him to commit the murder that he was acquitted of later. Now, we come back from Puerto Rico. We're editing the film. I own this in partnership with Warner Brothers. The next thing I know, we live very close to where he lived. We were in northern Santa Monica. He lived in the Palisades or Glenwood right near us. We're hearing helicopters over our house. We find out what happened. There was the murder the night before. They're chasing the white Suburban or the whatever it was that he was driving around in. And the next thing I know, the DA is calling, asking for all the footage, all the call sheets, stop editorial on it. All we did was make a 20-minute trailer. We made a 20-minute, what they call sizzle reel at the time, and never completed editing the entire movie. It never aired on NBC. And I decided I would leave episodic television. That was kind of, for me, the breaking point. That was 1994. I never had a doubt, and I could be completely wrong, but I thought he was guilty. I didn't, you know, I just thought, yeah, it kind of makes sense. He was very jealous. He's very reactive, and I didn't question it. But I went off to Toronto. I partnered up with Norman Jewison, who is a brilliant director. Who, you know, he did so many great movies, and we had an idea of making six short films with feature directors, bringing them to television for the first time, because in the mid-90s, feature directors didn't want to work in TV. But we were going to let them take their favorite piece of art and bring it to life in the form of a short story. So Norman was going to do one. Peter Bogdanovich I hired. That was the first time I worked with Peter. Bob Rafelson took a Hockney painting of a kid swimming in a pool with a man watching. Peter took the nymphs in the wood, the Botticelli painting with the diaphanous outfits, and made that the painting in the window of the lingerie store. Norman took another painting and turned it into Pagliacci. Joe Dante, for the first time since Roger Corman days, worked together with me again and picked a Remington bronze and turned it into a Western with Brian Keith. It was the last thing Brian Keith did before he blew his brains out. And we had Jonathan Kaplan came and did a Degas ballerina painting. These were short films. Yeah. And then I went to France in a castle with John Borman, and we shot a story about an anonymous painting that hangs in the Louvre with two naked women in a big bathtub, one giving the other a wedding ring. It's called Two Nudes Bathing. And it's performing wedding vows, topless, standing up in a gigantic bathtub. And I asked him why he wanted to make that story or make that painting into a story. He said, because he used to take Charlie, his son, who was the little boy in the Emerald Forest, by the way, but he would take Charlie Borman to the Louvre. They lived in Dublin, and he would take him to the Louvre, and that was Charlie's favorite painting. Well, naturally, the seven-year-old boy looking at two naked women, that was why it was his favorite painting.
Yeah.
But he was always, Borman was always fascinated by how did the painting come to be if it's anonymous. It is gigantic, if you've ever seen it. It's a huge canvas. How can it possibly be anonymous? So he wrote the story of how it came to be, rather than integrating it into the story as a visual.
It became,
how did this painting come to be? And it was the image of the painter who had taught the women about being adults and sex and marriage, and watched them from his attic window performing the rites in a bathtub, and falls out the window, wakes up and says, "That's what I'm going to paint." And it causes John Hurt, who plays the Count, to have a stroke and freeze the two girls who were totally being, you know, commandeered by their... So anyway, I branched away. I got away from TV and went to Showtime, where they were making movies. So those were six short films. It was called Picture Windows. And it wasn't really a series, although it's being... And Naked City was something. Once I got to Showtime, what I realized was Showtime in the 90s was the last bastion of independent filmmaking. They made $4, $5, $6 million movies. They didn't have any television series at all on Showtime in the 90s. Jerry Ofsted, who was the chairman, I think had also been president or so of Republic Pictures or something like that. One of the small, old, historically, you know, celebrated indie movie companies. And he went to Showtime, and his dream was to bring feature people to television and make a movie with the least amount of creative interference possible. It was the same kind of thing that we were doing on Freddy's, only here was an executive who ran a studio. And he came out to visit my facilities while I'm making Dark Justice. And he was impressed by the austerity of it all and asked how much it cost us to make the show. And, you know, and so when I left, I called him and he said, "You want to come and make movies?" And I did. And I was very fortunate to not only team up with Jewison on those six, but people started to come to me with projects. And a guy named Andy Girardi came to me. And he came to me with Naked City. Naked City originally was a film directed by Jules Dassin in the late 40s. It was called The Naked City with Howard Duff. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember who else was in it, but I've got a stilf of it on my wall over there. It won Best Cinematography, but it was the look of the movie was based on Ouija, Robert Ouija, the famous crime photographer. It was based on his crime photographs, and he put out a book, a collection of photographs in New York called The Naked City. So when they made the movie in 48, 49, it was called Naked City. Then you referred to, correctly, a television series that was made in the early 50s, the pilot of which starred Peter Falk, by the way, as the villain. He's on the run. It was the first and only, almost the only, a 100% on the streets of New York location television show. And it introduced to both television and audiences of all kinds incredible talent, both directors and writers and actors. So by the time Andy came to me with this, he bought the rights to everything. He owned the movie. He owned the original screenplay by Malvin Wald, and I can't remember who the other writer was. He owned the television show. And he thought it might make a good movie. So I instead sold a three-movie package to Jerry Ossay, three features. I said I would write them all. I would write and direct the first one. I would write the second one with Christopher Trumbo and get Peter Bogdanovich to direct it. And then the third one I would write, and maybe I'd have time at that point because I'd be done with mine to go back and direct it again. Yeah. So I made the first one. It was a feature, and that one had Scott Glenn, an actor nobody knew or cared about at the time, even though he had done a lot of really brilliant work, Giancarlo Esposito, and Courtney B. Vance, right, who had been in Hunt for Red October with Scott Glenn, which is one of the reasons I thought that Scott would be open to bring Courtney on. It's like, because I allowed Scott a lot of say in the show. Robin Tunney, Catherine Irby. You know, the list is really interesting on that movie. And then the next one that came along, Peter directed. The third one we never made because Jerry Ossay left Showtime. Showtime became more of a television series network by then. But I wound up making over a dozen films for Ossay and Showtime. Including Execution of Justice, which won a GLAAD award. The story of Dan White, who killed Harvey Milk and George Moscone in San Francisco, with Tim Daly. Okay. It was from the side of the killer, right? It was Tim Daly playing what makes a guy like that tick. And I got to meet a great director from Cuba named Leonie Chasto, who is a celebrated Cuban director, but also happened to direct a ton of Miami Vice episodes, which always made me really interested in him, the original Miami Vice. So I made my way back to TV after Showtime kind of went out of business as a movie franchise, and wound up making good connections with Paramount, because Paramount and Showtime are owned by the same parent company, Viacom. So I wound up on a deal at Paramount and started making television for them again, and then went right back to it. It's went to AMC, where I've been now for 9 years. So that's that in a nutshell. All I can say to everybody, not that I'm on the stage getting an award, which is not going to happen anytime soon, but thank you to everybody, because there is no way that anybody can ever tell you, in all honesty, that they got where they are on their own. I did it my way. The only my way would be to preserve your integrity. Don't take projects that you don't believe in. You know, don't compromise your own sensibilities more than you feel is bearable. You know, and always let everybody have a voice, because the quietest voice could be the most important. You know, you know, it's such a small business. After these few hours, you've heard the same names pop up in a lot of different places. Yeah. Watch out who you make an enemy, because that enemy is going to be your boss one day, right? There's no point to it, because as we all say, and it's become a cliche, but we could be selling shoes. You know, not that there's anything wrong with doing that. We could be selling insurance. We could be doing H&R Block income tax. We could be doing a lot of other things. It drives me nuts to hear people complaining about long hours of hard work when, for the most part, everybody's doing something that they love and they're getting paid well for it. People don't work for a dollar and a quarter an hour. They don't work for minimum wage either, unless you're a PA or an assistant. And even those people we try to do better for. But when you're in a craft, when you've got a skill, when you're in an artistic form of a position on a show or a movie, you're getting paid well for it. Nobody's forcing you to do it. And the great news about this, and this is what Antioch taught me. Remember I said I went to school for 6 months a year and to work someplace for 6 months a year. Sometimes it was 3, 3, 3, and 3. Is that nothing lasts forever. It's like summer camp. You make your best friend, and at the end you say goodbye and you may never see that person again. But in this business, 100%. Down the road, one day, sooner or later, you're going to run into them again. It's going to happen, and you're going to see them again, and you're going to hope that that experience was a good one, you know. And that's the way you try to leave things. And if you're lucky, you're proud of what you made, you know. And that's, you know, that's pretty much it. So, is there anything else I can help you with?
I would just like to say, beyond the thank you, yeah, of course, for taking this time and really making us both just, our minds are blown by, yeah, by being able to talk about this show with somebody who made it happen. I want to say a thank you because you, well, I guess I'm trying to think how to put this, because Freddy's Nightmares was that last bastion of a fandom that meant a lot, yeah, to me growing up. It was really special to me, but it was also something I always heard people say, oh, well, it's not, it's bad.
Yeah.
You'd always hear that. And sitting down and watching it over the last 24, 25 weeks, whatever, has been so much fun, has brought me so much joy. and apparently it's brought other people joy too, yeah, because of the podcast, but just watching it and having a great time with it was awesome. So I want to say thank you for making such a fun show that was really great.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it.
And I mean, to piggyback off of him, I mean, it's for one thing, you know, we've said on the podcast before, but the idea of the podcast was just something that Henrik threw out. And I mean, the fact that we had a basis to go off of this, but we've also had the opportunity to watch these episodes and break down the stuff. And I've been doing the research and stuff like that. It's just been an absolute blast. And it's kind of reinvigorated me for, you know, this kind of work that I kind of took for granted in a sense. It's just when you have an audience that enjoys listening to you and tells you that, it just makes it so much more worth it. And just getting to talk to you about this and fill in the blanks has been an absolute pleasure.
Well,
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I said this to you in the email, but your podcast does something that very few podcasts about film or television accomplish, which is that you make it fun to listen to, and you don't, you're not so academically skewed that you make it very serious. Your tone matches the show. There's a lot of humor. There's a lot of irreverence. There's a lot of just entertainment. And we weren't trying to do anything particularly serious or important at the time. We were trying to do exactly what you said. And I'm really heartened to hear that your reaction to the show is basically what our goal was. So, you know, but when I listened to the podcast, it's like, it reminded me to go take a look at the show a little bit, and maybe they're right, you know, because the amount of laughter was, you talk about episodes and picking out these tiny details, which you know, when you go to, if you're a lit major in college, you sit there and you pick apart a book or a poem or a short story, and every single word means something, and the teacher is going to make that word or that phrase or that thought way more important than the writer ever conceived of. Writers sometimes, yeah, just write off the cuff. They don't think about the detail. But when you're lucky and it's good enough, sometimes you can do that. You can play with it. Well, your analysis walks that kind of fine line between trying to find hidden meaning and just poking fun at and having a great time with it. And it's great that what you've become is kind of the extension of that show. You're just a continuation of it, you know. So,
well, speaking of which, there is somebody who would like to say something to you before we go. So, oh boy, I hope this goes well.
Hey, Jeff, how's it going? Fred Krueger here. Is your phone broken or something? Because I can't help but notice you never seem to pick it up.
Freddy, he's our guest.
Yeah, great.
That's brilliant.
Freddy, do you have something constructive to say?
I pretty much never have.
All right, fine. Well, we promised him we'd let him say something to you.
Have you ever reached out to Robert Englund?
It's on the list.
Dave's working on it.
Yes.
You know, I think, look, I haven't spoken to Robert in many, many years. It was a complete coincidence that he happened to live around the corner from us. Before I did Freddy's Nightmares, it was about 5, 6, 7 years before I did Freddy's Nightmares. But I knew that he was living there because I knew who Robert Englund was. He's now moved to another part of town, but he was, I can't tell you what a nice, smart, willing, patient person he was. Anybody who can put up with that amount of time in makeup, who's asked to do a minimal amount of work to play the same character over and over and over again. A lot of people feel resentful. Robert embraced it. He was wonderful at it. He's an excellent actor aside from doing Freddy Krueger, but nobody else could possibly do that. But I believe that if you reached out to Robert, he probably would be happy to talk to you guys. You know,
we're definitely working on it. Right now we hooked you. You were our big hope for the when we finished the first season. So now we can move on to some other fish.
Yes.
You know? But thank you so much, Jeff, sincerely from the bottom of my heart for taking this time to talk.
Of course, it was a pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
Man, when Double D and I put this show together, we never thought we'd get the opportunity to talk to somebody who really sat in the trenches of making this program, and it has been so cool. We hope you enjoyed that two-part interview as much as we did, and hey, maybe we'll get Jeff back. Maybe you guys should send in your questions for Jeff about the making of Freddy's Nightmares to freddysnightmarespod@gmail.com. If we get enough questions, maybe, just maybe, we can get him to come back on and answer them. But anyway, my friends, until next week, stay safe, and Springwood, if you lived here, you'd be home by now.